Even kids like it when chefs get involved in meals.
Do exercise and vitamin D prevent falls in older women?
Which type of injection right into your eye is best for macular edema?
And does stenting help after a stroke?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on March 27th, 2015, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I am so tickled by this idea that if we get chefs involved in school meals, lo and behold, we can get kids to really consume much more healthy choices. That's in JAMA Pediatrics.
Elizabeth, this is a pretty novel thought because when you and I went to school, a chef was the furthest thing from anyone's mind. But you and I are both aware that childhood obesity is increasing. About a third of children are now considered to be obese. And we know that if you're obese as a child, you're more likely to suffer from obesity as an adult. So there's a real desire to curb obesity during childhood. One of the ways that we can do that is by changing the way that we present food at school. This was a very innovative study in which they tried to do two things. One is to make the healthy food tastier. For that, they involved chefs. And then also to change what's called the architecture, the way that food is presented. So they went to 14 different elementary and middle schools in two urban, low-income school districts. There were over 2,600 kids involved in this study. And they were first randomized for 3 months to either a chef or no chef. And then after that, randomized to 4 months of making the food look more attractive, putting vegetables in the line earlier, putting fruit at the checkout center, and putting white milk in front of the sugar-sweetened milk. And what they discovered was when chefs were involved over the long term, there was an increased consumption in healthier foods. Now, it didn't happen in the first 3 months. It took the full 7 months. How the food was presented did somewhat change the selection, but it didn't increase the overall consumption of healthier foods.
Surprise, surprise. I have to say, this is rather an unsurprising finding. And this change from what you and I consumed when we were in elementary and middle school, mystery meat and its cousins, of course, is a good thing. I guess I'm not surprised that it took a little while for this to really phase in. I bet some of these kids were resistant to making those healthy choices at first, irrespective of how pretty they were.
Well, it's interesting because the study highlights it wasn't just the children, but also the administrators and faculty and staff as well. This didn't meet with enthusiasm from everybody, but it was clearly beneficial.
And gives chefs yet one more niche. I want to get one in my house. That's where I really want one. So from here then, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine and give kudos to the home team, Neil Bressler et al. Taking a look at, and I served it up as, wow, which intraocular or right into your eye injection do you want to treat your diabetic retinopathy? That's in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Johns Hopkins was involved, but this was actually an entire research network called the Diabetic Retinopathy Clinical Research Network, trying to find the best therapy for individuals that have diabetic macular edema. So let's take a step back and explain what that is. Diabetes involves the blood vessels, and those blood vessels in the eye can become leaky and leak fluid out, which can affect the vision. In fact, it affects the vision over 750,000 people in the United States. It's a leading cause of vision loss. And in the past, we used to treat that with laser therapy. There's a particular protein called vascular endothelial growth factor that's responsible for that abnormal leakiness. And we can actually intervene by giving direct injections to the eyes of inhibitors of this VEGF. And there are three currently out there that are available. One that's approved for cancer therapy, but is used off-label to prevent macular edema. So this study, which was conducted at 89 different clinical sites and involving 660 different adults that had diabetic macular edema, randomized them to receive one of three different medications: aflibercept, bevacizumab, or ranibizumab. Although these all work in the same way, there's a significant difference in what the cost is. Aflibercept cost about $1,950 for therapy. Ranibizumab's about $1,200. And the cheapest, the off-label use, bevacizumab, is just $50. What they discovered in the trial is that for people that had mildly impaired vision, they were all the same. They all preserved visual function to the same degree at 1 year. For the individuals that were most affected, they received best benefit with the most expensive of the three. Now, what this means is that 75% of individuals, they'll benefit from the least expensive medication.
And this, of course, has been an ongoing debate in this world because we identified these particular agents as useful in macular degeneration. Clearly, now that the other indication is diabetic retinopathy, it's going to expand tremendously the number of people who are going to be suitable candidates for this therapy. So this cost issue is really huge. I was lucky enough to interview Neil Bressler about this specific study, and I asked him, hey, does this say that people who have diabetes ought to be really vigilant about making sure that their eyesight is okay so that they can be candidates for the least expensive therapy at the earliest part of their disease?
And Neil's answer was?
It was, yes, it is. We really need to make sure people with diabetes see an ophthalmologist and get that retina looked at.
And do so on a routine basis. And by the way, the costs that I mentioned are costs for single injections, and these patients required 8 or 9 or 10 injections. The other thing we should mention is there's currently some perverse incentives for physicians to use the most expensive medications. Oftentimes, there are rebates paid directly to the physicians from pharmaceutical companies. We need to do away with all the financial incentives and the logistic barriers that prevent us from using the least expensive drug in people with mildly impaired vision.
I just would reiterate to patients that if they're vigilant about making sure that their vision is examined when they have diabetes, they can be in that group that can use the least expensive one. There are frequently, of course, co-pays, and they're sometimes really onerous for people to pay. On that note then, why don't we turn to something else that it was hopeful anyway, that it was going to be helpful in preventing dire outcomes. That's in JAMA Internal Medicine, a look at vitamin D supplementation, exercise, and the prevention of falls in elderly women.
We spent numerous podcasts talking about vitamin D. There have been studies to show that low blood levels of vitamin D have been associated with fractures, cardiovascular disease, colorectal cancer, type 2 diabetes, mortality, and an increased risk of falls. Based on that, this study was performed, a 2-year randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial where 409 home-dwelling women that were between the ages of 70 to 80 who had already experienced falls were randomized to either a low-impact exercise program, to receive daily vitamin D, to receive both, or to receive neither. What they showed was that the individuals who exercised were less likely to experience injurious falls. Not total falls, but injurious falls. In fact, it was cut in half, whereas vitamin D did not reduce the number of injurious falls.
I thought this was really interesting. And then what about the group who took both?
The addition of vitamin D to exercise did not improve what was seen with exercise alone. And by the way, the exercise was very modest. 1 to 2 days per week, 5 to 15 minutes at home, primarily balance and strength. And although it didn't decrease the number of falls, it decreased the seriousness of those falls.
We like this. That's such a good news study. I'm just going to leave it on that up note. Finally, then, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. All right, so we see that your arteries into your brain are starting to narrow, so-called stenosis. Should we treat those by placing a stent, or is medical therapy going to do the job?
And this intracranial arterial stenosis that you've already defined is one of the more common causes of stroke worldwide. 1 in 4 individuals that experience a stroke, despite good medical therapy, may experience another one over the next year. Hence, there's been enthusiasm for identifying those individuals whose stroke is caused by a blockage or stenosis that's somewhere between 70 and 99% and putting a stent in to prevent recurrent stroke. And that's what this particular study attempted to address. And I say attempted, it actually addressed it, but it was closed prematurely. It enrolled at 27 different sites around the world, and the ambition was to enroll 250 patients and randomize them to receive good medical therapy that was antiplatelet agents, to lower their blood pressure, to put them on a statin, versus that same medical therapy plus putting a stent in. And their outcome was simple. What percentage of people experienced a stroke over the following 30 days and 1 year? The 30-day outcome, recurrent stroke, occurred in 24% of those individuals who received a stent and only 9% of those on good medical therapy. And even following out to a year, 36% of those stented experienced a recurrent stroke versus 15% of those on good medical therapy. This informs us that stenting procedure is associated with its risk immediately related to the procedure and then even risk over the next year.
Once again, if we can avoid procedures and the risks that are inherent in that, that's a very good outcome. Not to mention the fact that we know that very good medical therapy is beneficial globally, not just in somebody's head.
as physicians, we oftentimes see a blockage and think, gosh, if we could do something for that blockage, we'd make things better. This is a circumstance where we see a blockage, and when we intervene, it actually makes things worse. It increases the risk of subsequent strokes. So your point's well taken.
All right. On that note then, of course, you know which one I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about the chef-enhanced meals on the blog this week.
And that's not any more likely to get you a chef at home, Elizabeth.
I know, and I'm so sorry about that. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.